Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is author and lawyer Philippe Sands, whose new book is The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. He's joined in conversation by historian Deborah Lipstadt. And now join Holly Furfer as she introduces Philippe Sands and Deborah Lipstadt.
Philippe Sands is an international lawyer, and since 2018, the president of English Pen. He's a frequent commentator on CNN and the BBC World Service. In 2003, he was appointed a Queen's Counsel. He lives in London and is joining us from overseas. And Deborah E. Lipstadt is here. She's a Dorit Professor of Modern Jewish History and Holocaust Studies at Emory University. She's the author of many books herself, including Anti-Semitism, Here and Now, which is a National Book Award winner. She also wrote History on Trial, My Day in Court with David Irving, a National Jewish Book Award winner. So please let me welcome Deborah and Philippe in conversation at the book festival in your living room. Hi, Deborah. Hi, Philippe.
Hi there, Holly. Thank you very much. Hi, Philippe.
Hi, Holly. Hi, Deborah. Great to be back with you, Deborah. And thank
exactly.
you.
Exactly. I know. Last time, Cape Town or Hay on Wye in Wales or someplace, but we keep bumping into each other.
Wonderful.
And more importantly, I keep bumping into and reading and assigning your books. And why don't we start by your talking about who Otto Wächter, the main person or the character around whom this whole story revolves, who he was and what he did.
Sure. Otto Wächter, Austrian, lawyer, born 1901, marries Charlotte Bleckmann, daughter of a steel magnate, anti-Semite, member of the Nazi Party as early as 1923, qualifies as a lawyer, goes up the ranks. In 1934, is involved in the attempted insurrection, coup d'etat, which fails to kills Chancellor Dollfuss, flees to Germany in 34, comes back in triumph in 38, and stands with Adolf Hitler and with his wife Charlotte on the balcony of the Heldenplatz after the Anschluss, goes into the government rather than back into private practice, spends a year. His first job as state secretary in 1938 is to remove all Jews from public office, whether they are the procurator general at the top of the Ministry of Justice or an ordinary postal worker, everyone in between, tens of thousands of people. He's then appointed to Krakow, where he becomes governor of Krakow. It is he who orders the construction of the notorious, infamous, terrible ghetto. And in 42, having completed his work in Krakow, he is posted personally by Hitler and Himmler to Lemberg to be the governor of District Galicia, where his job is to implement the final solution on the territory of Galicia in German Nazi-occupied Poland. The war comes to an end, and unlike his boss, Hans Frank, he escapes. On the 9th of May, 1945, he disappears off the face of the earth, and he does not reappear until the 13th of July, 1949, 4 years later, in Rome, in a Vatican-run hospital where he is dying under mysterious circumstances in the arms of a Vatican bishop, Alois Hudal, who ran the Rat Line. Alois Hudal of Mengele, Priebke, Eichmann, and notorious fame. So that, in a nutshell, is Otto Wächter. One other thing to say, Otto and Charlotte produced six children, and the fourth child is Horst, who we are no doubt going to be talking about.
Right, exactly. Now, how did you fall into this story? I mean, you did a wonderful movie on Horst and Hans Frank's son, Nicholas. But how did you get to this story? Because actually, the book is people who will read it, and I hope many of you, all of you will find out that it's not just the story of Otto Wächter, but it's and not or the story of Horst Fechter, but it's your story as well. It's got an 007 characteristic and feeling, you know, shoe leather detective story, how you did this. So how did you fall into this?
By accident, Deborah, in the best of possible ways. I was not looking for this story. I'd written an earlier book, as you know, we've talked about it, East West Street, which is the story of my grandfather. One thing you need to know I should have said is it's a very personal story. My grandfather was born in the city of Lemberg in 1904, Leon Buchholz. I knew him very well. He lived until 97. We were very close, but he never talked about what happened. And 10 years ago, I got an invitation to give a lecture in the university in Lemberg, today Lviv in Ukraine. And I accepted. I give a talk about the cases that you do as a litigator on crimes against humanity and genocide. And I did it not because I wanted to give a lecture, but I wanted to find the house where my grandfather was born. And in the course of that exercise, which led to the writing of the book, I came across a man called Hans Frank, who had been Adolf Hitler's personal lawyer, and who came to Lemberg on the 1st of August, 1942, and delivered a speech which announced the extermination of hundreds of thousands of Jews, including my grandfather's entire family in Lemberg. Hans Frank's deputy was Otto Wächter, and that's the connection between those two names. In writing the first book, East West Street, I did my research as I do when I'm doing a case, the Rohingya case or other cases of mass murder. I research everything. I want everything that's been written. And I came across a book written by the son of Hans Frank, Nicholas Frank, called Der Vater, the father, an excoriating critical attack of Hans Frank by his son. It was one of the most shocking things I'd ever read. And I thought, I want to meet this man. I tracked him down. He's about 80 years old now. He was 70 then. And I met him in Hamburg. And I was anxious because his father was the man who'd heaped so much misery on my grandfather's family. And I found a remarkable person, a world-class journalist. The first thing he said to me was, Philippe, you need to understand I am against the death penalty in all cases, except in the case of my father. And with that began a friendship. And out of that friendship, he said to me one day, you're interested in Lemberg. You know, you're interested in Wächter. Would you be interested in meeting his son? That was early 2011. I said, I'd be very keen to meet the son of Otto Wächter. Why the son would wish to meet me, I do not know, but let's give it a go. And in early 2012, Horst Wächter and I met for the first time, and there begins the story.
It begins an amazing and fascinating story. Now, there's another character in this story, and I know you are quite bedeviled, or you see her as the center. You and I have corresponded a little bit about this, and that's Charlotta, the wife, the ever-loving, much cheated upon wife who engineers much of Wächter's post-war disappearance. Right. Why don't we put her on the stage too?
Right. The reason we have to put her on the stage is I need to explain about Horst. So Nicholas Frank said to me, you will like Horst, but he's very different from me. He tries to find the good in his father. His father was indicted for mass murder, but was never caught and escaped. And Horst's view is, and Horst is not an anti-Semite, he's not a Holocaust denier, he's not a Nazi lover or apologist, but he tries to find the good in his father. He says to me, it's my duty as a son to look not just for the bad, but for the positives. Why does he do this? It's got nothing to do with his father. It's got everything to do with his mother. Charlotta marries Otto in 1932 because she's become pregnant. He doesn't want to marry her. She is an absolute anti-Semite, a repulsive and fascinating character at the same time. And for me, she's the beating heart of the book. Why? Because she eggs her husband on. She's complicit in everything he does. We know from the private correspondence, one point we'll no doubt come on to, is at some point in 2015, Horst gives me the entire family archive. In fact, he says to me, how can I prove, Philippe, that I'm not a Nazi? As a courtroom litigator, I know that it's very difficult to prove a negative. I reflect on the question, and eventually I say, you know what you could do? You've got all these incredible letters and diaries of your parents. You say they're not terrible people. Why don't you give them to a museum? And then a museum will allow access to scholars, researchers, ordinary folk. He said, that's a terrific idea. And which museum? And I said, the US Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. They'll treat the stuff seriously. It's now on the website, incidentally. Any of you can Google Vechter Holocaust Museum, D.C., and you'll get the archive. You can look at all of the documents. And he gave me 10,000 pages. He said, would you like a copy? I said, yeah, I'd like a copy. And it traces the entire life from the day they meet on the 6th of April, 1929, in a railway carriage in Vienna to the moment he dies on the 13th of July, 1949. And the point about family material is it's different from the public documents, the decrees, the terrible, you know, identifying the Jews, putting them in the Krakow ghetto and so on and so forth, because it is in the personal archives that you really get the true stories, what they know, what they're doing. And what emerges from this correspondence and the diaries is that Charlotta is an absolute true believer. She's completely complicit in the whole thing, and she's egging her husband on. And one of the things that I think we've never fully understood in this story of how highly educated, intelligent, cultured human beings like Otto Vechter and Hans Frank did what they did is what's the role of the spouses? And here we have a highly intelligent individual, a wife, appalling. But we can see through the correspondence what she knew and what she did.
And she helps him hide. I mean, even before the Vatican and the Rat Line get involved, she engineers his hiding right after the war, correct?
Well, I mean, I've known Horst for 10 years. For the first 5 years, I was interested. It was all about what your dad did during the war. Me trying to persuade him that his father was a mass murderer and a criminal, even though he was never convicted, which I believe to be the case. But it was only when I got this material in 2015 that a whole other story hove into sight. Actually, what happened to this guy after the war? 9th of May, 45, the war in Europe comes to an end. He disappears literally off the face of the earth into thin air. But in these documents, in the personal archive, we learn what has happened. And it's an incredible story. He escapes. He hooks up with a young Waffen-SS soldier called Bucco Rattmann, who is a mountain killer. His job in Italy and Yugoslavia is killing partisans and communists and resistors and Jews. And he operates in the mountains, so he knows how to survive at high altitude. He says to Vechter, I'll look after you. I'll take you to a place where the British and the Americans are too stupid and too lazy to look for us. We'll go up. We'll hide above 2,000 meters in the Austrian mountains. And they spent 3 years there together, and there's a lot in the private documents. At a certain point, I said to Horst, tell me about this man, Bucco Rattmann. He was 22 when he looked after your father. What motivated him? Why did he do what he did? What happened to him after the war and so on and so forth? Horst looks at me, he smiles, and he says, well, Philippe, I can answer all of your questions about Bucco Rattmann, or we could telephone him. So this is 2017.
When I read that page, I said, I don't shock easily. That is shocking.
So January 2017, I go off and meet Bucco Rattmann. It's the only interview he has ever given in his life. He explains why. Because for the entirety of his life, he has been worried he's going to get the tap on the shoulder. He has been involved in mass murder and war crimes, and he is worried for every day of his life that he will be arrested and tried, as so many of these people have been later on in life. And he makes it a condition of the interview that I ask not a single question about anything that happened before 9th of May, 1945. The moment you do that, he says, you're out. There were many aspects of this interview that were remarkable, and I describe it in the book. One of them, for example, was the direct confirmation that these two men, Rattmann and Vechter, followed the Nuremberg trial from high in mountain huts. How did they do that? Charlotte would come every 2 weeks, and she'd bring provisions, clothes, shoes, skis, all the stuff they needed to survive. And she brought the newspapers. And Vechter was interested in two bits. He wanted the sports pages and he wanted the Nuremberg trial pages. And he wanted the Nuremberg trial pages because three of his best friends were on trial. Hans Frank, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, and Horst's godfather, Arthur Seyss-Inquart, governor of Nazi-occupied Holland, the most hated man in Holland, why this book was a bestseller in Holland. Unbelievably, Horst sleeps with a photograph of his godfather next to his bed. Arthur Seyss-Inquart was hanged, as you know, at Nuremberg. There he is. Ratman has one other feature which is fascinating. As I'm interviewing him, I spend 6 hours with him, he is sitting in front of his bookshelf. And on the bookshelf, I can see a series of photographs. And there's one I can't quite make out. Tiny, round, I've put a photograph in the book. Only after I finished interviewing him do I go to the bookshelf. And I see that in January 2017 in central Germany, on the bookshelf of Buko Ratman is a photograph of Adolf Hitler. Those were the great days. And Ratman still treats them as such. It was very shocking, Deborah.
I want to turn to your relationship with Horst. As you know, it's intrigued me. It's intrigued me since the film, the podcast, and who Horst is, and also your relationship. But before we do that, two things that maybe you'll talk about a little bit. First of all, the Vatican's role in the Rat Line. And then, again, something that totally floored me, the very American angle to this story.
How long have you got, Deborah?
We don't have that much time, no. So you're going to have...
let's just start with Horst, okay? I have to say, the first time I met Nicholas Frank, obviously, Hans Frank, hanged at Nuremberg for the murder of 4 million human beings, 3 million Jews, 1 million Poles, I was deeply anxious. I needn't have been. He's an honourable and decent person, but his father had heaped misery on my grandfather's family and hence on my family. And I felt the same way about Horst. It's a different relationship with Horst. I'm very close to Nicholas. I'm not very close to Horst because he's not an apologist, but he's in denial. I would not have any sort of relationship with Horst if I thought he was an anti-Semite or a Holocaust denier. He is neither. In fact, he said to me the first day we met, and at all points subsequently, in a sense, Philippe, I'm giving you the material and I'm in contact with you to do penance for what the Nazis did to you. What he doesn't accept is that his father is a criminal. And he doesn't accept it not because of his love for his father, but because of his love for his mother. He will say to me, I didn't really know my father, but I knew my mother well. My mother loved my father. And I have to honor her memory by finding the good in my father. And therein lies the complexity. For all of us, the idea of honoring our parents is a hugely important part of our being. I had always heard of these stories from the other side of the story. You know, my grandfather lost basically his entire family. And so we were on the victim side. I'd never met someone until I met Nicholas and Horst who was on the other side. I'd never asked myself the question, how do you go through life as a child or as a grandchild, because the next generation comes in, if your dad murdered 500,000 people or 4 million people? It's impossible to comprehend. And I've come to understand the burden that these men who were both born in 1939 live with. They're not responsible for what their fathers did, for what their parents did. They're responsible to engage honestly with the facts. Nicholas does that. Horst doesn't do that. But on the other hand, Horst gave me all this material. And he's paid a huge price for that. He's been disowned by his entire family for talking to me. And this is the complexity of the situation. On the one hand, I feel repulsion for his denial. On the other hand, I feel gratitude for his generosity in making all of this material available. And that's the story in a nutshell. What the story took me to was this unbelievable period after the war. He escapes. Eventually, he decides there's no safety for him in Europe, so he wants to get to South America. And the Rat Line describes the Nazi migratory route, as it was known, from Italy to South America. It was followed by Eichmann, by Mengele, by Priebke, by Barbie, many notorious mass murderers. We know the names.
You're listening to author and lawyer Philippe Sands, whose new book is The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. He's joined in conversation by historian Deborah Lipstadt on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
What we have with this material that Horst has given me is, for the first time, I don't think it's ever existed before, the internal private papers of a man on the run and his wife. So hundreds of letters and their diaries. And part of the problem is they're all in code. And that's why we spent 4 years, I assisted by PhD, doctoral, master students, transcribing, interpreting, decoding, trying to work out what had happened. For example, apropos your question, the role of the Vatican. 29th of April 1949, Wächter arrives in Rome. He writes back the next day to his wife, Charlotte, who's in Salzburg, arrived safely, was met by the religious gentleman. So who is the religious gentleman? In none of the letters or in the diaries is the religious gentleman named. We worked it out with 100% certainty. It is Bishop Alois Hudal, who ran the rat line, who helped Mengele and Priebke and Barbie and others. The Austrian bishop in the Anima Institute, very close to Pius XII in the 30s. They became more distant in the 40s. And he helped Wächter get papers, parked him in a monastery where he was looked after by monks. The big question, of course, is what did Pius XII know? Now, I'll deflect for a moment because I've been helped by two remarkable historians in the United States to whom I want to pay credit. One is Norman Goder in Florida, who is the country's leading expert on the US and the rat lines. And the other is David Kurtzer, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his extraordinary book about Edgardo Mortara, who's the country's leading expert on Mussolini, the Nazis, the fascists, and the Nazis in that period. And with them, what I uncovered, or what Norman Goder gave me, because I take no credit for it, was an extraordinary document from 1947. I don't know whether you had come across it before, Project Los Angeles. It's an absolute shocker. 1947, the United States Army Counterintelligence Corps decides to set up an anti-Soviet, anti-Bolshevik, anti-communist network. And they hire an agent to run the network. The network comprises 8 individuals. They hire a notorious SS mass murderer, Karl Haas, to run Project Los Angeles. So already I'm seeing these documents thinking, hang on a second, 1947, they're hiring Nazis to combat the new enemy. Haas, with a man called Thomas Lucid, who later will become a major CIA figure, but who runs the CIC operation, then hire 8 sub-agents. 3 are senior Nazis, senior SS officers. 3 are members of the Italian Fascist Party, including the Secretary General of the Italian Fascist Party. And 2 are senior Vatican officials. Alois Hudal was an American agent. This really floored me. And the other Vatican official, it goes even more senior, even higher, the Pope's personal press spokesman, Cardinal, was an agent of the Americans. For 4 years, from 47 to 51, these 9 men were paid $50 in cash a month to report to the Americans on communist activity. The upshot of this is the Americans and Lucid knew all about the rat line. Not only that, there's a fair supposition, I think, that they contributed to the running of the rat line, and the rat line became a recruitment tool for anti-Soviet, anti-communist agents, even if they were Nazis. And I have to say, this really troubled me.
You know, I wrote a book on, as you know, on the Eichmann trial.
Yeah.
And so this was particularly intriguing to me because, of course, the CIA knew about Eichmann, knew he was in Argentina. Yeah. Everybody knew he was in Argentina. The Germans knew, everyone knew, you know, and it was no surprise in that sense. But going back just for a minute to the Vatican and the rat line, the fact that the Vatican was anti-communist is known, you know, how many that was the great enemy, that was the greater enemy than the Nazis. Yeah. That the Nazis not done some of the horrible things they did, including murder the Jews. The Vatican might have been quite happy to see them staying in power. But my question is, how much of it, certainly on a man with a man like Udo, how much of it was rank anti-Semitism? Not that they wanted necessarily more Jews to die, but they didn't give one whit about what had happened to the Jews, and in fact believed on some level that they deserved it.
I mean, in Hudal's case, there's no question, a deep, deep anti-Semite. I mean, active in Hitler Youth in the early 1930s, wrote a book which proposed a rapprochement between the Catholic Church and the Nazis, and premised largely on the, shall we say, sidelining of the Jews. Now, you know, there's a lot to be said about when the final solution hove into view. My own view is that this was not the original plan in 33, that it was one thing, you know, led That's to right. another. And then by 41, we know it was, that was the plan. And I think I'm often asked, what's the role of the Vatican in all of this? And it's a very complex and delicate question. There's no doubt in my mind that Hudal and others were deeply pro-Nazi all the way, full extermination. Does it go higher up? Here, I think one, as a lawyer and as a historian like you, one has to be very, very careful. It'll be for David Kurtzer and others to do that. My supposition, I mean, I got some information that Pius XII gave Hudal some money to help with the exfiltration of Nazis to South America, but not large sums. But when I saw that the Pope's press spokesperson, you know, his press attaché, the guy who speaks to the press every day, is an American agent and is paid $50 in cash a month. Now, I suppose he could have been off on a frolic. The Pope knew nothing about this. But it's counterintuitive. It's, you know, there's something that the lawyer's instinct, I'm a courtroom litigator, that seems pretty weird. There's another way of tracking this. You know, you've read the book. I have, unfortunately, he passed away a few weeks ago. My neighbor was for many years John Le Carré. And I had suddenly stumbled into what I knew about international crimes. You and I know about these things. What I don't know anything about, frankly, is the Cold War. John Le Carré knows about the Cold War. So I thought, okay, I'll go and see my neighbor and my friend. I have a role. I check his novels for the legal characters. Are they accurate? We worked together for 20 years. I said, I rang him up and I said, can I just ask you a few questions? I'm puzzled by something. He said, sure, send me some background documents on Vechta, on what happened. I'll do a bit of research. Come and have tea, bring some cakes. I spend an afternoon.
Six cakes, you say that very
precise. He liked his cakes, I have to say. And he literally lives 100 yards from me, you know. It's literally going around the corner. And I arrive, I record the whole thing. And he says, Philippe, this was amazing and interesting for me because I was there in 1949. I said, what? He says, yeah, I was 18 years old. I was a young British soldier, and my job was to interrogate Germans, to hunt for Nazis, senior Nazis, killers. And I said, to prosecute them, right? To put them on trials. You're hunting them. He said, no, it was very confusing. It was to recruit them. I said, to recruit them? He said, yeah. He said, believe you me, he said, it was very confusing for me. I'd grown up being told the Nazis were the worst of the worst. And now my superiors were telling me they're our friends against the Soviets. We were recruiting them for their Rolodexes. we wanted to know what they knew, because they had spent 5 years in Rome, basically anti-communist, anti-partisan, knowing who the troublemakers were, and we wanted their information. So we recruited them. And this was done with the Vatican. And one of the things that really amazed me, it's a tiny detail in the book, marvelous man I came to know, Thomas Lucid Jr., lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the son of Thomas Lucid Sr., who ran Project Los Angeles, who headed the CIC operation to recruit Nazis and others. And Tom Lucid Jr., like Horst, was just wonderful person in the sense of giving me all of the documents. Amongst Tom Lucid Jr.'s documents are letters in which I learn that in the late 1940s, Tom Lucid Sr. had a private audience with the Pope. Okay, now, why would a guy who's a relative, you know, he's in his late 20s, early 30s, running the CIC counterintelligence operation against the Soviets, recruiting Nazis and Vatican officials, be given an audience with the private audience, him and his wife, with the Pope? The supposition has got to be it was an alliance between the British, the Americans, the Vatican, and they didn't mind recruiting those who had exterminated the Jews. And this is the moral complexity that I stumbled across in writing this book. I knew nothing about this.
Right. Well, I'm reminded of the Tom Lehrer song about the Werner von Braun. You know, I'm learning Chinese.
You say Werner von Braun. I had a lovely email the other day from the wonderful novelist Laurie Moore, who had read the book and sent me a lovely note and had enjoyed the New York Times. She said to me she once gave a lecture in the Werner von Braun Auditorium somewhere in Tennessee, I think it is.
Unbelievable. Let me put you on the spot a little bit. You alluded to this earlier, Horst, and I'm glad last night I went back and watched My Nazi Legacy, where you bring together Nicholas and Horst and you bring them to London, et cetera, et cetera. And Horst is an amiable figure. He's a nice guy. He seems like a nice guy, though Nicholas, Hans Frank's son, at times is disgusted with him. He brings a speech that his father gave and stands in the place where his father gave it. And your father was standing next to him when he said he's going to exterminate all the Jews in the region, et cetera. But nonetheless, and I understand from the point of view of the lawyer and the point of view of the investigator, the historian, that you're working with Horst got you. This book would not be unless you had worked with him. And yet I sent you this morning when we were finalizing details of this conversation, the famous cartoon, the NAS cartoon from Boss Tweed. I don't know if you were familiar with it before, but Boss Tweed, who ran Tammany, who ran New York City politics in the beginning of the 20th century and really was corrupt in the extreme. And this one cartoonist, Thomas Nash, brought him down. He wasn't the only one, but his relentless cartoons. And there's a famous cartoon of all the people who had benefited from Boss Tweed and helped him, each one pointing their finger to the next person, you know, he's responsible. Horst is in a difficult position. He's been rejected by his family. You may be the only friend he's got, you know, in that sense. Yet on some level, even though he doesn't deny it, he says, my father had nothing to do with him. I'll finish here so you've got time to respond. I remember when I first started going to Germany as a graduate student, everybody would say to me, you know, people my generation obviously had no responsibility, born either as children late in the war or born after, you know, the merciful birth of being born after, would say, oh, terrible, terrible. My father was on the Eastern Front, i.e. my father didn't do anything wrong. And I always used to think, if all those people were on the Eastern Front, the Germans would have fared much better on the Eastern Front. So at what point does it become a son's love for his mother extended to his father and a failure to take personal responsibility, which when you go larger is really important?
Yeah, no, this is a huge question. I've thought about this so much. I mean, Horst is in denial. if I thought he was in denial because he was sympathetic to what his father did, I would cut relations immediately. I was so anxious about Horst's well-being at some point that I retained the assistance of a psychoanalyst and a psychiatrist, okay? Because, you know, I didn't want to create a condition where he would do something terrible. I was really, I and the filmmaker for My Nazi Legacy, David Evans, we thought we were pretty worried. You know, was I going to be pushing him over the edge? There are some scenes in the film where I push him very, very hard, as you know. And he doesn't, he almost cracks. He almost cracks, but he somehow doesn't in the end. Right, exactly. And I came to understand by talking to these two very senior individuals, one psychoanalyst, one psychiatrist. They described it to me like this. Horst is like his Schloss. He's like the castle that he has, that he lives in. He's in total poverty, but it's a huge space. The walls are, you know, like 5 feet thick, and it looks strong and solid. And he said he's like the castle. On the outside, it looks impervious, it looks tough, it looks impenetrable, solid. But the moment you go inside and you see the state of it, you can see it is on the verge of collapse. And they both said to me, be very careful, because it's on the verge of collapse. And if it collapses, anything could happen. And here at a human level, you know, I feel I have a responsibility. I have a protective function. My commitment to Horst was that I would fairly and faithfully reproduce what he said. So that,
which you do.
Which I do, possibly a little too excessively, but that's because he keeps repeating himself. I set out my views. My views are very clear, I think. I'm not in agreement with his views. The reasonable reader will form their own view. But I owed him that. And he has not criticized me for that, except that he does continue to send me letters complaining that I have left out all sorts of documents which show what a great man his father was. I keep saying to him, where are the documents, Horst? Show me the documents and I will put them in. There's nothing. There's nothing there. And as you know from reading the book, buried in the 10,000 pages of documents, at a certain point, I finally read one of the modern documents, which had slipped into the collection by accident, in which Horst writes to his nephew 5 years before I met him. And he says, in terms, I've been through all of the documents and I'm afraid it's terrible. He knew everything. He was totally implicated. And he knows, but he can't permit himself because his world comes to an end. He's constructed this world. And I think it comes back to the centrality of why I think personal documents are so important, because they explain where the role of the family becomes so important. You and I know, because we've met so many people from Austria and Germany. Germans and Austrians generally deal with these things a bit differently, I would say, but Austria is a big silence. In fact, I'm just finishing a piece for the New Yorker magazine for the online version on the remarkable statement given by Arnold Schwarzenegger after the 6th of January events. It's an extraordinary document because he basically says, look, I'm an Austrian. I know about these things. I know how one thing leads to another. We need to be really, really careful there. And then he talks about his father.
And doesn't admit what
his... But he never says, my father was a Nazi. He skirts around it. He sort of alludes to it. I knew what he was saying. You knew what he was saying. But most people who read that document, it's not what he says. And so the piece that I've written includes a couple of interviews with friends of mine in Austria, one of whom said to me, no, Philippe, no Austrian can ever say, my father was a Nazi, my grandfather was a Nazi. And Horst is part of that generation because they grew up being told we were the first victims, the 1955 treaty.
That's right.
And it has tainted two generations. But let's look at the bright side. As you know, I'm a great fan of the wonderful Leonard Cohen. The song, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Horst has a daughter.
Yes, yes. And that's the final line, final line of the book, which knocks your socks off.
Because the daughter takes a different position.
Right. And that right. I won't yeah. reveal that.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is author and lawyer Philippe Sands, whose new book is The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. He's joined in conversation by historian Deborah Lipstadt. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at KALW.org.
Philippe, thank you so much. Thank you for the book. Thank you for your friendship, which is always fun. And we've been together in many things. And now I'm going to turn it back to Holly. And I see their questions in the Q&A. Well done, friend.
Fascinating.
Well done.
Right. And we're not done with you, Deborah. I want you to be a part of this discussion, too. So you're not off the hook because you've got a lot to add.
I'm not going anywhere.
Okay, good. So let me ask you really quickly first, out of curiosity, you're talking about a film, Philippe. What film is that for people who don't know?
Right. It is called My Nazi Legacy, What Our Fathers Did. And you can get it on Amazon. It's on Amazon Prime. It's on... I'm just getting the name as we speak because it's a different name. It's a different name in Britain and the United States because the producers had a row about it. What Our Fathers Did, A Nazi Legacy. I'm very pleased to share with you. It's only got 5-star reviews and it's 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is a good thing.
Wow. Great.
It's also directed by my dear friend, David Evans, who directs Downton Abbey.
Oh, you know it's going to be good. You know it's going to be very good. Okay, so let me dive right in with this question. Why did the Vatican help the Nazi war criminals? Were they anti-Semites? Is the Vatican still anti-Semitic?
Question one, it was about the communists. It was about the Soviets. You need to go back to Italy, 47, 48. There was a real fear in the Western world, the British, the Americans, the French, the Vatican, that Italy would become the first landing point for Soviet intervention in Western Europe. There was a big election in 48, and those countries wanted to make real sure the Communist Party of Italy did not win that election. And there was a lot of input, shall we say, by the Americans and the Vatican into that election. And the Christian Democrats won the election. And that, of course, created... you know, NATO, Red Army faction, and so on and so forth. So at that point, it was an anti-communist alliance. But interestingly, this resonates still today because you will remember 2 or 3 years ago, Steve Bannon was having contact with anti-Pope Francis individuals. And that was about essentially the same thing. Is the Vatican anti-Semitic today? What I can say is this. I wanted to get into the room in which Otto Wächter died. It's a Vatican-run hospital, an extraordinary place called the Santo Spirito Hospital, built in the 15th century, where Leonardo used to go and witness operations and withdraw them. And I couldn't get in. A friend of mine went to give a lecture in the Vatican in the summer of 2019. And I begged him to find someone in the Vatican who'd help me get into this building, because I like to go and see where things happen. After his lecture on art and literature, on faith and literature, there was a cocktail and he met a bishop and a cardinal. And my name came up in conversation and the bishop and the cardinal said, Philippe Sands, isn't he the one who made that BBC podcast, The Rat Line? And my friend Javier Cercas, the novelist, said, yes, it is him. And the bishop said, not very complimentary about the Vatican, but I loved it. I want to meet him. I'll help him. And I think that gives you a sense of how things have changed. And of course, Pope Francis, correctly and courageously, has opened the archive. And people like David Kurtz now have access to it. And I think in the coming years, it will take time, we will know what the Vatican knew and did. We don't really know. There is speculation, there are arguments in different directions, but we will know. But for now, I have to say my own experience is of deep gratitude to folk in the Vatican who assisted me in this project, even though it would not show some of the things some of their individuals got up to in a positive light. And I'm very appreciative of that.
So, Holly, you have a question from a young man named Matthew, who is actually watching from Britain, who's one of my students.
So oh, I
I'm
love
gonna
that.
Play teacher prerogative and ask you to answer the question.
Okay, I will. Now I want to get to Matthew's question because this one's heavy lifting and I love this question. And I can tell Matthew is brilliant and he's learned it from his amazing professor because listen to this question. Dr. Lipstadt and Dr. Sands, you both have confronted denialism in the academic or historical sense, but also on a more personal level. What has served you most effectively in these confrontations? And is it possible to ever truly destroy denialism when its own existence represents a triumph against the, quote, mainstream? I don't know, but Deborah, you got to give him an A. I mean, I can't, the question was like...
Well, we have class tomorrow, so I'll make sure to give him a
please,
shout out.
Please.
Philippe, why don't you take a first stab at
well,
it? And
then I'll... You know a thing or two about denial, Deborah.
You go first. Okay. A couple of things. I, of course, confronted David Irving. With a great team of lawyers, one of whom a good friend of Philippe's, Anthony Julius, who also, like Philippe, has a foot in the academic world and the legal world. And the way we fought David Irving was with the truth. We followed his footnotes. It was an academic enterprise. We followed his footnotes back to the sources with an A team, a dream team of historians, Richard Evans, Christopher Browning, and others. And we just showed that he was a liar. Now, the question is, did David Irving believe what he was saying? And Anthony's partner and one of my other lawyers, James Lipson, and I talk about this very often. People, of course, who Philippe knows. Did he really believe it? And I think almost like Horst, you know, I've never made this jump, that David Irving worked, I don't call him a historian because he's a liar and he falsifies this, but he knows the historical documents. He reads the historical document, making it very clear that there's shootings on the Eastern Front, 30,000 here, 10,000 there, adding up to over a million of Jews. But it says Jews and partisans. So he says, oh, these were people rebel. You know, he knows what the documents say. He knows the truth. But then he goes through this strange psychological mechanism, which I've never analyzed because I'm not a psychoanalyst or a psychiatrist, but I have, as you have, talked to people about it, where he convinces himself that, you know, this couldn't be. He finds ways of convincing himself. Now, at his heart, unlike Horst, David Irving is an anti-Semite and a misogynist, and they and a racist. They also often the tripartite three, you know, go together so well. But that's one of the reasons why I never spend any time engaging deniers or trying to convince deniers that they're wrong. The people I want to reach are the people whom they might influence, whom they might plant a seed of doubt. But it's a very hard thing to do. Look, we're going through denialism in this country, denialism of an electoral process where, you know, 7, 8, 9 million votes would have had to be, you know, changed in some way. Denialism about vaccines. You know, if it's inconvenient history, inconvenient events, you deny it. I don't know, Philippe, does that make
sense?
Well,
I mean, I've learned from you. I mean, I followed the trial in London. I've read your book. I've read lots of other books that have been based on your extraordinary story. It's the truth. At the end of the day, you know, measure for measure, William Shakespeare, the truth is the truth until the end of reckoning. That is what we have to focus on. But there are real parallels. It's really interesting. As you speak, Deborah, I'm thinking to one extract in the book. There's one letter. I deal with it in the book. You remember December 1939, Otto Wächter is in Krakow, and he writes home to Charlotte, and he says, marvelous, wonderful being the governor. All the famous people are coming. The Vienna Philharmonic is coming to perform. Famous writers, it's marvelous. A little bit of local difficulty. And the governor general has been attacked and there are car bombs and resistance. Tomorrow I have to have 50 Poles shot. Now, this letter was accidentally left in the family archive. I'm pretty sure that Charlotta will have filleted some of the horrors out, but this one she missed. So I take it, I translate it, I transcribe it. I go back to Horst and I say, look, Horst, you say your dad was a good guy. Here is a war crime. This was personally ordered by Adolf Hitler. It was the first reprisal killing in Poland, December 39. It was a crime, period. No ifs and buts. Horst takes the letter and he says, yes, of course, but look what it says, Philippe. I said, it says tomorrow I have to have 50 Poles shot. And Horst says, yeah, but Philippe, it says tomorrow I have to have 50 Poles shot. It doesn't say I want to have 50 Poles shot. And that is the kind of interpretive technique that is used to avoid confronting the truth. And your role, Deborah, and my role, you as a historian, me as a lawyer and as a writer, is to basically constantly bat away. Holly, it's your job too as a presenter for CNN, constantly bat away on the facts, the facts, the facts. But I come back to one thing. Again, I want to be very clear. Horst and Irvine are not in the same camp. The reason I'm able to be not sympathetic, because I don't like his interpretations, is that I understand that it is a familial thing and it's a personal survival thing. You know, Horst Wächter, as a young man, was the assistant to a very famous Austrian artist called Hundert Wasser. You know, he did the crazy buildings in Vienna that are very famous. Why did he work for Hundert Wasser? He said to me, I worked for Hundert Wasser because he was Jewish. It was a way of doing penance. It was a way of saying, I'm sorry for what has happened. And he remembered, he described to me an encounter he had with Hundert Wasser's mother, who was Viennese and Jewish, and who knew the name Wächter. And the name Wächter filled her with terror, because she knew what Wächter had done. And so deep in his heart, the real reason I think he's given me this material is, he won't say it in these ways, it's a form of penance. He wants it out. There's a part of him that wants it out. You know, who gives this material to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, which then puts it on its website? That is not the act of a malign individual.
No, it's... I'd much rather have coffee with Horst than I wouldn't have coffee with David
yeah,
Irvin.
I wouldn't have coffee with Irvin. Yeah.
Right. The book, this book, East West Street, but especially more than the movie, My Nazi Legacy, or what Our Fathers Did in the War, whatever the title, wherever your title you're using, gives truth to the biblical quote that the sins of the fathers are visited on the sons. Uh-huh. And you see that in Horst.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Philippe, thank you so much.
I have one more question. Don't end now. Oh, wait, good. We got to keep this going.
Yeah, no, hang on. I'll go on for hours, Holly. I'll go on for hours.
Let me ask you one last question, because we haven't really touched. We've talked a lot about the father, but can you explain why the mother, Charlotta, was so virulently anti-Semitic? Because she was just as bad, if not worse.
Oh, she was worse. She was appalling. She's just an absolutely appalling individual, but fascinating at a human level. And, you know, just before I answer that question, let me just say how this relates to my own work that is connected to current political events. I'm doing the case at the International Court of Justice for the Gambia against Myanmar on the treatment of the Rohingya, the genocide against the Rohingya. December 2019, we had a hearing in court, and I was there for 4 days. And I sat right next to Aung San Suu Kyi, literally 1-2 meters from me. She argued for Myanmar. She defended the indefensible. And I'm sitting there thinking, why is she doing this? Why is she? She's come to The Hague. She's come to the World Court. She stood up in front of the world and defended genocidal acts, saying they're not genocide. Yeah, a little bit of war crimes here and there, but no genocide. And it came to me. It's about her relationship with her father. Her father was the inventor, the founder of the Tatmadaw, the Myanmar army, which had been responsible for these terrible atrocities against the Rohingya. And this relationship between a daughter and a father is replicated in Horst's relationship to his mother. Blood is thicker than anything else. Charlotta was born into an incredibly wealthy, well-to-do Protestant family in a small town called Mürzschlag in Styria. She had everything. Her father ran the steel mill, employed a quarter of the town's population. There were 25 Jews in the town, so it's not as though it wasn't Vienna where the Jews were very present, which gave rise to particular problems in the eyes of the anti-Semites. She grew up without any, I mean, why would someone like that become so anti-Semitic? And yet we know by the time she was 18, she was anti-Semitic. Why do we know that? Her diary in 1925, she's a troublesome child. Her parents think, we'll put you in an English boarding school. That'll teach you a thing or two. She comes to England. She thinks the English are more nationalist and more fascist than the Germans and the Austrians, incidentally. That comes out of it. She loves the English because they're so nationalist. On the way to England, she writes in her diary, train on the way to Frankfurt to Hamburg. I flirted with a Jew. Okay? I mean, it's really interesting. So there is anti-Semitism, but there is also fascination. And in her writings, periodically, you get a hint of her bitter anti-Semitism, and it comes right at the end. 1945, as the war is collapsing for the Germans and the Nazis, she writes to Otto, get in touch with the Führer, she said. I've got a great idea. Let's enter an alliance with the British against the Soviets. The British know about nationalism. The British will be with us. Now, she says, I know why it's not going to happen. It'll be because of the Jews contaminating everything, getting involved in everything. Now, where this comes from is very hard to explain. In the case of her husband, it comes from his father, who was a rabid anti-Semite, and that we can trace. I think, and I say this with great regret, in her case, it came from the church. It came from a bishop who was very close to her family, Pavlikovsky, who ordained Alois Hudal. And I think that the link between the church and the anti-Semitism of Charlotta is, in my view, established. I say that with regret because I wish it were not the case, but that seems to be the primary source.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. It is fascinating. And I also want to mention that if you want another amazing read, Deborah's book, Anti-Semitism Here and Now, which was a National Jewish Book Award winner, is phenomenal. So thank you both for being here. You honor You're us welcome. With your presence and with your writing and your work and your research. We just so appreciate you. What a fascinating conversation. I look forward to the next one. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Stay safe.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was author and lawyer Philippe Sands, whose new book is The Rat Line, The Exalted Life and Mysterious Death of a Nazi Fugitive. He was joined in conversation by historian Deborah Lipstadt. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rosh Hashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.